Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 148, Roger Johnson and Gene Upton.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, greetings and salivations, greetings and salutations, that's how it goes. Welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Burt Walder.
And we are drooling at the prospect of welcoming our guests to the program today. But before we get to that, how are you, Burt?
I am okay. How are you?
I'm satisfactory, I think, as it would go.
Well, Nero Wolfe thought satisfactory was the highest compliment and praise that he could offer.
Well, I think that's fairly accurate. I like that. I like that. Satisfactory and just Jim Dandy.
Satisfactory, Jim Dandy, olfactory, all kinds of factories.
Don't shut that factory down. Well, we have a wonderful show lined up for you today. Of course, you can find show notes at ihose.co/ihose148. That's ihose.co/ihose148, all lowercase. Our handle on the socials is I Hear of Sherlock. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, those places where we will post images and links and obviously links to the show when it is published. Just a reminder, if you can, subscribe to us. Wherever you're listening to us right now, whether it's our website or a podcast player, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an update. And most importantly, share this with someone you love. Share it with a Sherlockian. Share it with a family member. Share it with someone whom you think could benefit from learning about what's going on in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, share it. And for goodness sake, also, give us a call. Let us hear your voice. Let us know what's on your mind. Have a hand in shaping our content, the shape of these programs. Contact us. You can do that any number of ways. You can call us at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. Or you can send us an email to comment@IHearOfSherlock.com. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. We're all I Hear of Sherlock. And that rug that's in the guest room there, just to the right of where you're listening to this, we're actually under there as well. So you can just find us everywhere. You're expecting us in some places you're not.
I didn't know we were under that rug.
Yeah.
Wow. It was hard to breathe.
Yeah, and by the way, you folks need to step up your vacuuming. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the dust bunnies were fierce. Well, you know what is also fierce, but in a good way?
I can't imagine.
Our friends at Wessex Press.
In the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex, July is Hay Manath, the time when we mow and make our hay harvest. We cool off by turning to Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers, Volume 3, edited by Matthias Bostrom and Matt Laffey. These newly discovered stories for the last 6 months of 1893 show Conan Doyle, the celebrated author, lecturing on English literature, and they report the presumed death of Sherlock Holmes at the Reichenbach Falls. Get your copy right now at ourwessexpress.com. Then came hot July, boiling like to fire, that all his garments he had cast away upon a lion raging yet with ire. He boldly rode and made him to obey. Cool your summer reading with a new book from the Wessex Press. Choose yours today.
Well, we are pleased to welcome two icons of the Sherlockian, Holmesian world. Of course, they are Roger Johnson and Gene Upton. You know, we have had Sherlockian couples on before. We've had Al and Julie Rosenblatt on episode 103. We have had Tyke and Teddy Niver on episode 126. And this is a further installment in that series. This is really another two members of the Florin Society. The Florin Society, of course, is not official, but it is just kind of tongue-in-cheek. It is when two members of the Baker Street Journal happen to be, two members of the Baker Street Irregulars, who each hold a shilling, happen to be married. And when you get two shillings, that is a florin. And in this case, we have Roger Johnson, who received his investiture in 1991 as the Pall Mall Gazette, and his then-American wife, Jean Upton, who received her investiture in 2000 as Elsie Cubitt. Highly appropriate, since Elsie Cubitt was from Chicago and left the United States to marry Hilton Cubitt in England in The Adventure of the Dancing Men. So highly appropriate there. Roger and Jean are both stalwarts of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, about which we're going to talk with them, and want to talk about their unique backgrounds, how they met, and more importantly, how they get access to the inside of the sitting room at the Sherlock Holmes pub. Roger and Jean, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
Hiya, thank you.
Well, it's delightful to have both of you on here, and I suppose we will begin where we begin with all of our guests and ask you how and when and where did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
Well, in terms of my first introduction to Sherlock Holmes, it was probably through the Basil Rathbone films being shown on television. And then when I was six, I started reading the stories for the first time. I had been stuck in bed and in my bedroom for God knows how long because I happened to catch every possible childhood disease one right after the other. So I didn't have anybody to play with. My mother couldn't have cared less. I read every child's book that we had in the house and then started on the other stuff. And the first one happened to be Sherlock Holmes.
Wow. Well, that sounds like perfect conditions under which a small child can make these discoveries. Unfortunate
well, yeah,
as it was.
And I was fortunate in that I learned to read when I was about 3.5 or 4. So I was able to read well enough to understand most of the words in the original Conan Doyle stories. And what I didn't understand, I could look up in a dictionary.
Yeah.
Mm. So, Jean, roughly how old were you then? I mean, you're not reading this at 4 and 5 years old.
No, I was reading the Sherlock Holmes stories at 6.
Ah, 6. Wow.
Yeah.
You may be, among all the people we've interviewed, you may be the earliest discoverer of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What else? What else were you reading? Or, I mean, you said you sort of read all the childhood books, and what else made an impression on you?
I was reading Kipling. there were a lot of British children's books in our house because one of my great uncles was British. And I had an older brother and sister, so these were books that would have been given to them that I discovered. So I discovered Mary Poppins probably a decade before other people did. And trying to think what else we had. Margarita Angeli was another one. She happened to be a friend of my grandmother's. And the name might not be familiar to you, but if you look her up on Google, she happened to live in the town next to us, oddly enough.
Where was that, Jean?
I grew up in Wincote, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And oddly enough, I grew up in a house where Christopher Morley had lived.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was renting the house for a couple of years with his family while he was waiting for his own house to be built about a block and a half away. It was right next to the Jenkintown-Wincote train station, so he was able to commute into Philadelphia where he was working at the time.
Now, did you happen to find any Morley family artifacts in the walls or anything like that?
No. I wish we had.
How did you find that out?
The real estate agent who sold my parents the house knew of it. And Steve Rothman was able to confirm it because he came across some correspondence with the address on it.
Well, I'll be darned. That's really amazing.
Yeah. And what's rather nice is when Roger received his investiture in the BSI, it was given to him in that house.
How did that work?
Well, Roger had come over for Christmas to meet my family when we first got engaged. And I think Tom Styx was still recovering from surgery. So Bob Tomalin presented it to Roger at the house because Roger wasn't going to be able to stay long enough to attend the BSI dinner.
Oh,
that's fabulous. Huh.
Yeah, so nice, unique way to receive the investiture.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to add to that that the fact that my investiture was given to me in December meant that I just scraped into the class of 1991 along with the first women to be invested with all rights and privileges, which was rather nice.
Good company to keep.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the day after the party, Jean drove us up to Norwood, New Jersey, where we had dinner with Tom and Dorothy Styx.
Hmm. It's lovely.
And I'm so glad she was driving. I could not have coped.
Well, Roger, tell us about how you first met Sherlock Holmes.
I don't honestly remember. I seem to have been aware of Sherlock Holmes all my life, but I suppose it was the image that I was aware of, the deerstalker, the pipe, the magnifying glass, and inevitably, elementary, my dear Watson. The first I became aware of the stories was not on television or on film, but on the radio, because I grew up with the series on BBC radio with Carlton Hobbs and Norman Shelley. And for a very long time, theirs were the voices that I heard in my mind every time I read one of the stories. The first of the books I read was probably The Hound of the Baskervilles. The older I get, the less certain I am that it was that one, but I think it was. And I would have been, I don't know, 9 or 10, I guess, certainly older than Jean was when she first read stories from the canon. But I do remember that the Hound gave me a nightmare, and I was so gripped that I wanted to carry on reading the next day.
Well, that's true dedication. No doubt. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the sign of a damn good storyteller.
It sure is.
And at that point, did you go through the rest of the stories? What was how sticky was that Hound of the Baskervilles experience for you?
I'm not sure when I decided I wanted to read all the rest of it. Certainly, I was really hooked by my mid-teens. And I knew about the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, but I thought, well, these people are adults, and they're obviously deeply intelligent and educated, and I'm not going to fit in. But I was a joiner. I joined various clubs and societies. Let me see. A slightly roundabout story here. One of my favorite writers was, and to an extent still is, H.P. Lovecraft. Sure. And I read all I could of Lovecraft, and I discovered through my researches and through knowing about Arkham House and August Derleth, I discovered Solar Ponds, the Sherlock Holmes of Praed Street. And I discovered that there was a Solar Ponds Society, the Praed Street Irregulars. And I got that from the Arkham House catalogue, which was issued by the European agent, nice guy called Ken Chapman down in South London. I used to buy books from him and have them delivered to my school because I didn't want my parents to know how much I was spending on books. Yeah. And from the catalogue, I learned of the Praed Street Irregulars, and I wrote to the man in charge, Luther L. Norris, of Culver City, California. Yeah.
Yeah, Luther, yeah.
Yeah, sadly, I never got to meet him. We were going to meet when he was on a European tour with his wife, but very sadly, she died in Rome. And
oh dear.
Of course, he cut the vacation short, went back to America. We continued corresponding until he died, and I regard him as, in many ways, the best friend I never met. Mm. He persuaded four of his Pontian Sherlockian friends to write to me. Two of them, God bless them, dead now, Ted Schultz and John Bennett Shaw. But the other two are still very much around, and we are still very good friends, Peter Blau and John Lellenberg.
Oh, very
so
good.
So my first contact with the Sherlockian world came about in a rather roundabout manner, and through Americans. So I've always had this American connection.
Well, now let me ask you a question here. You said a few minutes ago that you remember reading The Hound of the Baskervilles, and your experience of reading The Hound gave you a nightmare.
Oh yeah.
And then you've described your fascination with H.P. Lovecraft. So didn't Lovecraft, you know, which is, you know, much darker and scarier and mysterious.
I was a little older when I discovered Lovecraft. I got into ghost stories and supernatural horror, and I'm still very much interested in that. I've written, about 30 stories myself, which have been published, but I've done nothing in that line for quite a few years now.
Yeah.
I've had stories picked for the year's best horror stories and best new horror, and you know, for a comparatively small output, I'm rather pleased with the result.
Mm.
Never going to make me any money, but.
And how did you find, so there you are, corresponding with people in America, finding connections between Holmes and Solar Ponds and H.P. Lovecraft and all these common interests, and thinking that there they are, the good and the great in the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. So when did you first connect to the Sherlock Holmes Society of London? How did that come about?
Well, I realized that Luther was a member. And now, if I'd been really savvy, I would have looked in the London telephone directory. It never occurred to me that the society would be listed in there. But I asked Luther, and he gave me what turned out to be Lord Donegal's office address.
Oh, goodness.
The editorial office address, and his secretary, Cecilia Freeman, put me on to Margaret Gunn, who was then the membership secretary. And from there, well, never looked back, except in nostalgia.
Oh, that's wonderful. So how old were you when that happened, roughly? I mean, were you still in your teens?
No. It was 1968, so I would have been 20, coming up to 21. It was all the press and media attention that the first trip to Switzerland attracted. And I thought, this looks such great fun. I just have to try and join this society. And that was what really stimulated my, stiffened my resolve. Stiffen up the sinews, summon up the blood, and all the rest of it.
Now, do you remember your first meeting?
I can't remember what it was about, but I remember that one of the first people I met was Michael Hardwick. I'd just sprained my ankle. Stupid. The only set time it's ever happened to me, I'm glad to say. I'd just moved into a new flat as a student, sharing a flat. And in the dark, I fell downstairs. So I was hobbling when I got to the meeting. But what that particular one was about, no, I'm afraid I can't remember. I could tell you exactly where it was. It was our regular meeting place, which was the Royal Commonwealth Society, very close to the Sherlock Holmes pub.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, you didn't happen to accompany the group that time around to Switzerland, did you?
No, that was, it was the, all the reports of the trip to Switzerland.
Oh, I see.
No,
it's afterwards.
My first overseas trip with the society was 10 years later, the second Swiss pilgrimage. Mm.
So, Gene, we've heard an awful lot from Roger here about the people that he's met, the societies that he discovered, in particular, the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. Mm-hmm. But what about you? When did you first discover this world of Sherlock Holmes beyond books that involved these strange and fascinating and similar people?
Well, I probably first was aware of various societies and groups in the 1960s. In the 70s, I would have liked to have gotten involved, but I had the misfortune to be married initially to someone who didn't like anything that took attention away from him. And he threw out all my books.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Good grief.
So needless to say, that marriage ended, and I moved out to Los Angeles for 5 years. Tried to hook up with Sean Wright's group out there, but despite writing to him several times, answer came there none. So it really wasn't until I returned to the East Coast in the 1980s that I started hooking up with some of the local groups, and then also joined the Sherlock Holmes Society of London around 1986 or 87. And then my first meeting with the Sherlock Holmes Society happened to be also my first visit to the UK, which was in December 1987, when the Society was visiting the Granada Studios in Manchester when the Jeremy Brett series was still being filmed.
Wow.
Yeah, good first meeting.
Yeah, not bad. Not bad.
And it was a bit bizarre, too. It was only about 6 weeks after my father had died. So I was not in the best of shape anyway.
Yeah.
Jet-lagged. Showed up at the studios, and when they discovered that I had traveled all the way from the United States, the Granada promotions team really went to work on me. And I was photographed with Jeremy Brett and the other members of the cast, and then taken away to be interviewed with Jeremy and led around basically by the scruff of the neck and discovered a couple of years later that all of this was used to promote the Granada Studios tour. Nobody bothered to tell me this. I discovered this by way of Peter Blau, who sent me a photocopy of a press clipping with my photographs in it. Yeah.
Well, that worked out pretty well then, didn't it?
Yeah.
So what are your memories of that? I mean, that is just extraordinary. There you are, jet-lagged, having suffered this loss, in the center of attention. What were your impressions of Brett and the operation, and anything surprised you? I mean, you must have gotten a lot of impressions.
Everyone was very nice. But, you know, it was all a bit of a blur. One good thing came out of it, because I had sort of been hauled off to the side with the photographers and everything. By the time we got back to the interior set, the rest of the society had gone over to where there was a reception that afternoon. And so I had the whole place to myself to take a lot of detailed photographs. And many, many years later, when most of the set had been sold to the Granada Studios tour and they wanted to film another series, in order to reconstruct the set, my photographs were used, because nobody else apparently had ever bothered to take any. Which I think is very strange, but there you are.
Well, it's funny. You know, I imagine, you know, if you're in production, you would think that the set designers and the decorators would have taken photos. But if you're busy recording the movements of actors across all these scenes and so on, I imagine it probably doesn't occur to you to take, you know, special
stills.
Well,
I don't think they really ever expected it to be such the phenomena that it was. But they could have either sat and watched through hours and hours of videotape taking notes, or, you know, everything was there in a plain photograph for reference, which enabled them to match up a lot of things and beg, borrow, and steal others.
Well, you know, at some point we should turn our conversation with you and Roger to, you know, another great stage set of Sherlock Holmes, which is the exhibition from the Festival of Britain, the elements of which you and Roger have been maintaining at the Sherlock Holmes pub for a very long while.
Yeah.
So you have unique experience in various major settings of the Baker Street saga.
Well, the funny thing about the pub is I remember when I was quite young, and it must have been about the time that the pub had reopened as the Sherlock Holmes. A friend of my mother's used to subscribe to a lot of magazines, and one of them had photographs of the sitting room. And I remember seeing those, and I would have been, I guess, about 6 or 7 at the time. Can't recall. Younger, Roger says. But I remember looking at them and thinking to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to go and see that sometime? And, of course, it was decades later that I finally got to the UK and went to the pub and went to see it. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful to get inside there sometime? And then after we were married, it was before I was able to work legally, I went up to London one day and had lunch there. And I looked into the study and I was thinking, that looks in really bad shape. And I discovered from talking to the managers, there had been an overhead leak from either a washing machine or a dishwasher that had gone through the ceiling, and it caused a fair bit of water damage, and stuff was dusty, and it was just in bad condition. So I said to them, look, I'm associated with the Sherlock Holmes Society, who were the people who put together this exhibition in the first place. Would you allow me to go in there and sort it out for you? So that's how it all began.
That's fascinating. When you go in there, though, do they paper over the windows so people don't see the scene marred by a modern human being, or are you in the free view of everyone?
Well, no, because when I first started doing it, it was in the days when pubs closed for several hours in the afternoon because of the licensing laws at the time. So I was able to go in there when no members of the public were there and just roll up my shirt sleeves and really get down and dirty with it. And then what we've discovered in later years, Roger and I will go in there quite often, you know, when people are having lunch, and the people are vastly entertaining to see what we're doing. So it's never really been a problem.
Sure. Now, have you found anything in the sitting room that surprised you or that you perhaps didn't know was there before because it was obscured from sight?
The weird thing is the stuff that's actually been stolen from there.
Oh, no.
Because unfortunately, previous managers over the years would rather indiscriminately let members of the public in there to take photographs. And I think brass knuckles disappeared. We had to actually replace the boxing gloves. How somebody managed to steal them and why they stole them, we still have no idea. But one item that really bugged us to lose, which was present when we first started looking after the room, but then disappeared one day, there was a hypodermic case, which was either silver or stainless steel, that had been engraved to reproduce Arthur Conan Doyle's signature on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that went. And again, we've no idea how or where or when. We think we know possibly how, but we're not absolutely certain. I'm trying to think. We have found odd little scraps of paper, notations as to where things were purchased for the exhibition. And we've, of course, added a lot of stuff in there because things have been damaged over the years. But I think at this stage, Roger and I know the contents of that room as well as we know the contents of our own house.
Oh, that's great. Now, when did you and Roger first meet?
Well, Roger was on that trip in 1987 to Manchester, but we never actually met. We were in a photograph together. Separated by one person who was Tony Howlett. And it wasn't until 1989 when the Society went to Cambridge that we finally met. I had been subscribing to the District Messenger, so we were corresponding. But that was the first time we were actually introduced to each other.
Roger, what? So Jean mentioned that before you had actually met, she had subscribed to the District Messenger and so on. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the early history of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London and how the District Messenger came about?
Well, the early history of the Society, and it goes back to 1951, when there was a there was the Festival of Britain, which was the government had decided after, you know, it was a period of austerity after the Second World War, and the government decided that we really need what they called a tonic to the nation. There's not much physically left now of the Festival of Britain, but it was a big thing. The main survivor, I suppose, is the Royal Festival Hall, just over the river, actually, from Charing Cross Station, very close, in fact, to the Sherlock Holmes pub. The borough of St. Marylebone, which doesn't exist any longer, it's been subsumed into the city of Westminster, the borough councillors like all the local authorities in the country, decided, they were going to contribute to the festival. They would put on their own events and displays, and they thought the appropriate thing was an exhibition about slum clearance. And this idea attracted quite a lot of criticism, especially in the newspapers, and it began with a letter supposedly written by one Dr. Watson. And there were followed letters from Mrs. Hudson, from Inspector Lestrade, and even one absolutely genuine from the actor Arthur Wontner. All of them, of course, saying, Marylebone, the most famous resident of Marylebone, Sherlock Holmes, why not do an exhibition about Sherlock Holmes? And the council hummed and hawed for a little bit, and they said, yeah, all right. So the exhibition was put on. It was organized by the Borough Library. The Borough Reference Librarian, a man called Jack Thorne, he was the mastermind. It was housed at the building that occupied the site of the only house that has ever legitimately borne the address 221 Baker Street. That was an office block called Abbey House, home of the Abbey National Building Society, who, since the 1930s, had employed someone on their staff to reply to all the letters that were addressed to Sherlock Holmes at 221B Baker Street. They knew it would be great publicity for them. The Borough Council knew it would be great publicity. And the exhibition was laid on. And it was a huge success. Material was borrowed from the Doyles, from the Pagets, and from all sorts of other people. Items were donated. Items were occasionally bought for the exhibition. As I say, great success. It included the full-scale reproduction of the sitting room at 221B. The people who actually worked on putting the thing together included, four volunteers from outside. Professor Bill Williams, Mr. Colin Prestige, Mr. Anthony D. Howlett, and Miss Alfreda Pierce, as she was then, who was the assistant to Jack Thorne in the library service. A little over a year later, Tony Howlett and Frieda Pierce were married, and Frieda Howlett, as she now is the last survivor of the founders of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. Wow. She will be 100 years old in September.
Oh my goodness.
God bless. Yep.
After a day's hard work putting the exhibition together, they went to a nearby pub called Allen's Bar, and over a refreshing glass or several, decided it was time that Britain had another Sherlock Holmes Society. There'd been one before the war, as you probably know, whose inaugural meeting was held the day after the inaugural meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars.
Yes.
And one of the founder members of the Sherlock Holmes Society, as it was called, brought a message of greeting from his brother, the brother being Christopher Morley, and the man in question being his brother Frank, who was living and working in England. He was in publishing, and at one stage he shared an office with T.S. Eliot. But getting back to the Sherlock Holmes Society, it flourished from the beginning. Numbers grew. A year after the inaugural meeting, the Sherlock Holmes Journal was established. And come 1957, Whitbread the Brewers, who had they'd become rather fond of the idea of what they called feature inns, what we now tend to call theme pubs. and they thought it was time for a Sherlock Holmes pub. And they owned this rather nice one, just close to Trafalgar Square and Charing Cross Station, called the Northumberland Arms. It had formerly been the Northumberland Hotel. And it was ideal as a Sherlock Holmes pub. So they bought a fair amount of the material that was hadn't been claimed one way or another from the Sherlock Holmes exhibition of 51. They got Jack Thorne in again to supervise the exhibits around, and he brought in Michael Waite, the stage designer who had designed the 221B sitting room at the exhibition at Abbey House. And the room at the pub is, I suppose it's what, about a third the size of the original, but it has all the important features. And it's very little changed, really, from what people would have seen in 1957. But the Sherlock Holmes Society of London has had a connection with the pub, really, since the beginning, not just through the exhibition, the fact that they both have their origin, in a way, in the 1951 exhibition, but we've discovered photographs from the official opening of the pub at which the Society's president, S.C. Roberts, the editor of the Sherlock Holmes Journal, Lord Donegal, and group officer Jean Conan Doyle and her sister-in-law Anna, they're all there, all in the pub and celebrating the official opening. So, yeah, the society and the pub share a history. Now, you asked about the District Messenger. Well, the journal appears only twice a year, half as often as the Baker Street Journal. And it's not the ideal means of informing people about, say, plays. And that was the original purpose of a newsletter, which we originally called the Grapevine Service because we couldn't think of a better name for it. And then one of our members, Tony Medawar, had the bright idea of calling it the District Messenger, which is an excellent name, I think. I volunteered to write it and distribute it, which originally, of course, was all typewritten on a hand, you know, a manual typewriter, then photocopied and all sent out by post. And it grew and it grew. And after 32 years, I passed it over to another of our members, and Jean took it over 2 years ago. And nearly all the subscribers, of course, receive it now by email. And it's also posted on the Society's website. There's an entire archive on there. And it covers a great deal more than plays. Just about, I have, Peter knows this very well, of course, but we have taken inspiration from Scuttlebutt. Of course we have. Scuttlebutt is the father and mother of right. Sherlockian newsletters.
Now, how often does the District Messenger come out?
In my time, it was always irregular. That was a given. Jean has established it as a monthly.
And if folks would like to, obviously, if they want to take a look at it, they can go to the Sherlock Holmes Society of London website. We'll have a link in the show notes. How can they sign up to get it by email?
Well, if they go to the Society's website and they look at it, at the top of each issue, in fact, they will find Jean's address and email address, district.messenger@yahoo.com.
Like all these things, an undertaking of love.
It is, but so is what you're doing.
Well, it's love and hate for us.
One gets frustrated, of course, but that must be true of all. You know, everything you do for love, it goes with being a true amateur, and after all, that's what amateur means.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, it's, you know, it's wonderful, the themes of all of this. You know, you mentioned S.C. Roberts, who, in addition to everything else, was one of the great early writers about Sherlock Holmes and among the first to collect information, essays, insights, speculations mm-hmm. into books. So this goes back decades and decades and decades to Father Knox and others. And publishing and sharing, when you have these enthusiasms and ideas and things spark you, it becomes very convivial and writing things down and publishing. But the wonderful distinctive thing about the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, where among the many wonderful distinctive things about the society, which we haven't even talked about, you know, we talked briefly about the trips to Switzerland, but there are so many other things like the summer cricket match. You know, I've been a member for decades, and when I lived in you know, I've only attended probably a handful of meetings over the years when I've actually been in England.
We're just going to pause for a moment. When we get back to Bert's line of questioning, we'll get into the digital aspect of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. The Baker Street Journal continues to be the leading Sherlockian publication since its founding in 1946. By Edgar W. Smith. With both serious scholarship and articles that play the game, the journal is essential reading for really anyone who's interested in Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and a world where it's always 1895. We're about halfway through 2018 right now. And yet it's still not too late to get your subscription to the Baker Street Journal. If you haven't visited the BakerStreetJournal.com site lately, you may have missed some of the contents there. Contents of both the summer 2018 issue, as well as news and other publications by the BSI Press. Publications like Trenches, The War Service of Sherlock Holmes, Mobile Homes, Transportation in the Sherlockian Canon, and of course, Dancing to Death, as part of the BSI Manuscript Series. You can check all of this out and more on BakerStreetJournal.com and get yourself caught up with Sherlockian scholarship today.
Among the distinctive things about the Society is the website. You know, the compared to other Sherlockian groups, the Baker Street Irregulars included, the Sherlock Holmes Society of London has always had a lovely website and merchandise available for purchase by members and so on. How did the Society's adoption of digital technology and a web presence come about?
Yeah, that's one of those good questions that I can't really give you an answer to. We had someone who was a bit of an expert in that line, Calvin's son, who set up the website. Yes. Well, we've been lucky to have a couple of people who had expertise in that way. And the one was the son of our former treasurer, Charles Markham. His father, Calvin, is still very much a present in the society. And our current webmaster, Johnny Huff, is excellent. And he's a member of the society himself. He attends meetings. He knows what gives. He is so helpful and so encouraging. I do a certain amount of posting information on the website. And I would never have had the slightest idea of how to go about that had it not been for Johnny's encouraging tuition. You know, as an old man, I'm happy to learn from young men or young people. And you learn to do things that you never thought you would.
Now, at a certain point, Roger, you took on the editorship of the Sherlock Holmes Journal, which is the official publication of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. Again, membership is open to anyone. If you go to the website, you're You're greeted with options based on geography, based on level of participation, and every member gets a subscription to the journal as part of their membership.
That's right.
So how did you fall into the editorship there, and what kind of professional or even amateur qualifications did you have at the time?
Amateur is about right. NICU Tekin is the longest serving editor. 30 years he did. He was remarkably young when he began, but he had as co-editor. You have to remember that editorship of the Sherlock Holmes Journal is actually a joint affair. There's the person who chooses the content and edits the contents, which is what I do, and the person who attends to the layout and deals with the, what you might call the practical side of it, also deals with the printers and the distributors. In my case, that's Heather Owen, who has been doing the job for more than 40 years, which is startling. And she's the unsung heroine. She learned her trade from Patsy Dalton. Patsy was a professional editrix and journalist, Fleet Street. She was married to actually one of the first of the editors of the Sherlock Holmes Journal, Philip Dalton, who he was a journalist, but he spent most of his career in the PR department at Scotland Yard.
Huh.
James Edward Holroyd, who was his partner as the original two editors of the journals. He was a professional journalist himself, and the writer of the first letter to the Times saying, "We want a Sherlock Holmes exhibition," in 1951. So we have had professionals doing the journal, and as far as I'm concerned, thank goodness, digital technology has made it a damn sight easier for amateurs like me to do some of the work.
Well, that's great. Well, you know, I mean, between, you know, diving in and participating in some of this, and as you say, as you said before, Roger, learning from the younger generation coming along. I mean, this is fascinating to hear, because you know, we run into our share of Luddites in Sherlockian circles who have no inclination toward getting themselves up to speed technologically. So it's encouraging to hear that there are still some curious minds out there with regard to modernization.
Don't misuse the word Luddites.
Well,
people who aren't interested are not necessarily Luddites. Luddites were the people who smashed up machinery. Yeah.
Well,
I don't
verbally,
think we've got too many of them in the Sherlockian world.
Yeah, they're verbal Luddites, let's put it that way.
Yeah, okay. I was very lucky in my job. I was a librarian in public libraries for many years, and I remember at one stage saying, if I'd wanted to work with computers, I'd have trained to work with computers. But of course, computers became an inevitable part of my job. And I am more grateful than I can say to my employers, Essex County Council, for insisting that we all underwent training to use computers.
Sure.
Somewhere I still have it. It seems it's an absurd title, but I have the European Computer Driving License.
How does...
And heaven knows who came up with that.
Wait a minute, Roger. You say you have the European driving license for this. So when you are doing that, are you doing it on the right side of the road or on the left side?
Sounds like a hard drive to me.
God knows who came up with that name. It's a silly term, but it was a good training course. Very good. I was very lucky with my tutor.
Yeah. And Gene, we've been hearing an awful lot from Roger about the Sherlock Holmes Society and his official role there, all things editing and writing. But it sounds like, and we know you're involved in the District Messenger now, but it sounds like your talents earlier on were more visual. You know, you mentioned the photographs from the Granada tour. Are you trained in photography or?
No.
Just a hobby?
I always enjoyed photography from the time I was quite young.
Hmm.
But, it's just an interesting way of recording events for me.
There's another visual connection, that we have or that we're aware of. With you and the Sherlock Holmes pub. You know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
would you care to share that with us?
I assume you're talking about the Arthur Conan Doyle portrait.
Yes.
Well, how that came about was there used to be in the pub a pastel portrait by Henry Gates, whose large oil portrait of Conan Doyle now hangs in the National Portrait Gallery. And I just thought, you know, it really ought to have a portrait of Conan Doyle. And I think it was, 1994, the Society was having its Back to Baker Street Festival, which I think went on for about a week. Yeah, it was quite a lot of different things going on. So I volunteered to paint the portrait for the pub. And I used the Gates portrait. The portrait gallery was able to supply me with a photograph of it because at that time it had been in storage for God knows how long. And then I also worked with other photographs of Conan Doyle in order to come up with the new portrait. So that was unveiled by Dame Jean Conan Doyle and Michael Cox, who was the original producer of the Jeremy Brett TV series.
Now, that's probably about as big an honor as you can get if you're doing a portrait of Conan Doyle.
It was pretty cool, yeah. I'm pleased to say, by the way, that the portrait by Gates is now back on display at the National Portrait Gallery.
Oh, that's great.
Because I had been pushing them for years, as had other people. It required apparently a fair amount of repair and restoration, which has been carried out. It looks very bright now, and we have actually been to see it. But I'm delighted that it is finally back up for the public to see.
Yeah. And your portrait is still available for the public to see?
Yep. It's in the upstairs restaurant.
Excellent. Well, once upon a time, and you may not be aware of this, Gene, Sir Arthur and I faced each other down in the pub.
Oh, yeah.
There was a charcoal sketch that was commissioned by David Houle in New Hampshire.
That used to hang. In fact, I think it is still hanging in the restaurant.
Yeah, I posed for it. And
a young Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes when he first came up to London, and he brought a copy to the pub, and they went and hung it, and it was on the wall directly facing Sir Arthur for quite some time.
Yeah.
So we have that connection, Gene. You know that spiritual bond. I like that. Now, one of the things that we touched on here and there is, you know, your association with Roger, that you were nearby each other during your first trip but hadn't met. You mentioned early on in the program here how he came over to your parents' house in Pennsylvania. But connect the dots for us. How did the two of you ultimately begin corresponding? And what led to that fateful day when Roger proposed to you?
Right. Well, the correspondence began when I became a member of the Society and learned of the newsletter. And I think Roger said I'm one of his first overseas subscribers because when I first started coming over to London on a regular basis, I set up a British bank account so I was able to send him a check to cover the postage of posting it to me when I was still in the United States. And then I was coming over to London each year for meetings with the Society because they would have extended weekends away in different parts of the country where the stories took place. So that was my annual holiday. And it was a wonderful way for me to see the country in the company of friends because I always traveled on my own. So this was quite a nice change for me. So the thing was, with these weekend events, it was always very rushed trying to get around to say hello to 70 different people and never really getting the opportunity for a good long conversation with anybody. Yeah. And then in 1991 was the Society's trip to Switzerland, and that I think was 8 days, something like that. So it was a much more relaxed atmosphere, plenty of time to talk on the trains or the coaches, and that was how we got to know each other much better. And then I came over again in July of that year, and that was when we were engaged. Roger came over to meet my family in December, and then in April we were married.
Well, that was pretty quick.
It was a leap of faith.
Yeah.
When you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was, 27 years ago?
Well, yeah, we've been married 26 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it might be on to something there, Jean. It might be working out.
Well, it was funny. I was working for a couple of doctors in Philadelphia, both of whom were British. And they had a lot of difficulty getting anyone to stay with them because they were a bit difficult to work with. And I guess I'd lasted the longest of anyone as their assistant and office manager. And when I told them I was getting married, you could see the blood drain from their faces when they learned I was actually moving to England. And in order to stop me from going, they were going to give me something like $10,000 up front and increase my salary by $10,000 a year.
Wow.
And I said no.
Wise choice, yeah. I mean, Roger is worth at least twice that. So you've been at the forefront of the movement in London with the Sherlock Holmes Society. You know, wonderful excursions every year. Obviously, the big annual dinner at the Houses of Parliament. People rave about that. You're helming the district messenger now. So you, like us, hear of Sherlock everywhere. What's your take on the world of Sherlockiana at this moment and where you think it's going?
Well, it's nice to see that there are a lot of younger people getting involved in it. And I know, like, some of the young ladies in particular have received a lot of criticism, because their initial introduction seems to have been through either the Benedict Cumberbatch TV series or the Robert Downey Jr. films. But my attitude has always been, you know, however you get your first introduction, inevitably it's going to lead you to the original stories. And this, wonderfully enough, is exactly what we're seeing happen. Mm. I had a funny thing happened to me yesterday. I was up in town at our local Oxham bookshop, and there was a man in there with his teenage daughter. And they were trying to look for books that would interest her, because she was at that stage between reading children's books and reading adult books. And I was earwigging a bit as they were talking to the volunteer in the shop. And I said, well, have you ever read any Sherlock Holmes? And she wrinkled her nose and she said she'd read some and didn't like them. And I said, well, which ones have you read? And she named the titles of some of the more recent pastiches. And I said, well, those aren't really Sherlock Holmes stories. What you want are the ones by Conan Doyle. Well, she'd never heard of Conan Doyle.
Oh.
So I picked out a couple of paperbacks and suggested she try them. And hopefully I've set her on the right path.
Yeah.
But that is one of my concerns. There's an awful lot out there that a lot of people think is the real thing. And I can see how people would be put off Sherlock Holmes if they read only the pastiche.
I can too. You know, there are some wonderful pastiches out there that are a great deal of fun. But if that's where you think...
But there's a lot of drag.
Oh, there is. There is. But if that's where you think Sherlock Holmes begins and ends, that can be quite limiting.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know this was one of the concerns of Dame Jean, because that was how I first became associated with Dame Jean. She was getting a lot of flack over the fact that she had criticized, I think it was Michael Hardwick's Revenge of the Hound. And a lot of people really gave her a lot of grief over that. And I wrote supporting her. Mm. And she said, well, basically, my concern is that people won't get around to reading my father's stuff. Mm. And her attitude was that if someone was that good a writer, they should be capable of making up their own characters. Oh. And we're starting to see a bit of her nightmare come true now, I think.
Yeah.
As you say, there are some very good pastiches.
Mm.
But there's an awful lot of stuff that just shouldn't be getting published. It's just not good enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing about pastiches is that the challenge with these sort of eternal characters, Tarzan, Robin Hood, Sherlock Holmes, Superman, that it gets all sort of jumbled together. You know, it's as if it's a long journey, and at the end of it, all of your experiences from starting out at home to arriving at your destination become jumbled in one thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not the case. You know, the original stories, that narrative voice, the approach to plotting, the discovery along with the author as the reader is discovering more and more about the characters and they become real and they have various interactions and you find these great moments. I mean, that really defines, you know, the saga and what we call the canon. And the fact that other people can put, you know, similar characters with identical names and situations to do this, that, and the other thing, you know, I hadn't thought about it, but it's a new idea to me that there would be people who would just think that pastiches and so on would be it. And it's very, very far from it. You know, it's as far from it as a Superman comic book today is from the original Superman back in the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah. I think what I object to the most is that some of them are just so poorly written.
Well, you know, it's tough. It really, you know, if it's an easy thing, if writing well would be an easy thing, there would be many more Nobel Prizes for literature.
I know. It's unfair of me to criticize because I don't write fiction. My brain just doesn't work that way. But I just struggle, you know, when I see misspellings, sentences that don't string together properly, poor punctuation.
Well, you don't have to be a writer to criticize.
Yeah,
you're a reader.
Know.
So, you know, you have standards. That's all right.
Yeah.
As we all should.
But even just, you know, historical errors, things like that.
Yeah. Well, and also inappropriate language use. You know, when you read a lot of one particular author's work, you become pretty familiar with that author's lexicon, how the sentences are strung together. Mm-hmm. And when characters say uncharacteristic things, you know, it really sort of leaps out at you.
Yeah. But, you know, everybody has their own take of Sherlock Holmes, so fine.
Well, that's what makes this such an interesting hobby.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, Roger, the world of Sherlock Holmes, you know, just continues to evolve here. And you've been, you know, kind of at the point of the spear for quite a while, you know, between your editing of the journal and the newsletter. What do you see as happening next? Where is this going?
I'm not a prophet. I leave that to other people. I'm delighted when something new and interesting happens. I'm especially delighted when something new and interesting and really good happens. But I could not have foreseen the success of Sherlock. I certainly didn't foresee the success of Elementary, nor did I foresee the advances in digital technology would enable the huge, must be infinite, quantity of Sherlockian pastiche that Jean was just talking about. I'd no idea all that would happen.
You think this internet thing's going to catch on?
Oh, I think it might, you know. I think it might, yeah. But I'm not a prophet. I wouldn't like to bet on it.
Well, I think, as you've observed, it is difficult to predict which way these things are going to turn, or what's going to spring from the next inspired person's mind. But we are here, and we are enjoying all of it as it comes. And these are some watershed moments, like the Rathbone films were, like the Granada series was. You know, there are these points in our history that you can point to, that every generation has its homes. And the character just finds a new way to become relevant to each successive generation.
What I will I will say, and I'm sure that this will prove to be true, for decades, certain people have been saying, you know, everything of interest that can be written about Sherlock Holmes has already been written. There's no point in writing anymore. And we get really, really good articles, books, and so forth. I'm constantly finding excellent material sent to me for the Sherlock Holmes Journal. I still have a backlog that will last us for at least the next 5 years.
Wow.
I'm gradually whittling it down. There's splendid material being published in the Baker Street Journal, in the Watsonian, in Canadian Holmes, The Passenger's Log, Proceedings of the Pondicherry Lodge. I love that. That's the Sherlock Holmes Society of India's online, or I should say PDF journal. Excellent stuff.
And do you read any of the what comes out of France, from the Société?
I have to skim through it because my schoolboy French isn't up to that much, I'm afraid, but I know very well that there is very good material coming from France, from Switzerland, from Germany, from Sweden, from Italy, from Japan. I have to take it on trust that the Japanese material is good, except when someone translates it. But I know that the Japanese scholars are excellent scholars and very nice people. We were delighted, a couple of years ago, was it? Or was it last year? The Japan Sherlock Holmes Club celebrated its 40th anniversary. And Jean and I, Catherine Cook and Heather Owen and Charles Foley were invited to join them for a celebration at the Sherlock Holmes pub. And it was a considerable honor.
Yeah. Well, you know, I recall, Roger, a few years ago, actually probably more like 10 years ago, at a BSI dinner, you gave a speech and talked about the Gilded Age of scholarship of Sherlock Holmes. And you remarked that, the Gilded Age, we do remember it fondly. There were giants of our hobby then, but that, it wasn't all over. You know, we didn't have to simply look back with wistfulness thinking this will never happen again. Mm. I mean, there are certain things, you know, the first time a chronology comes out, or the first time an annotated version comes out, of course, there will always be firsts. But I seem to recall that you remarked that while that was the Gilded Age, we are now in the midst of a Golden Age.
I can't remember whether I said exactly those words, but I was actually quoting Frieda Howlett at the Sherlock Holmes Society of London's 50th anniversary meeting. She said, "The Golden Age is now." And it continues to be now, and that's what's really wonderful about our world. It seems to be a continuing golden age.
It does indeed.
Yeah. Bernard Davis died. I wrote in the Sherlock Holmes journal, there were giants in the earth in those days, and it seems right now that Bernard was the last of them. But even then, I knew that wasn't true. There are still giants, and we're lucky to know them. We're lucky to work with them, and we're lucky to enjoy their work and their company and their friendship. Yeah. Friendship is essential in our world. I forget who it was, one of the early Baker Street irregulars who said that he hoped he wouldn't be shot down as a heretic, but he did think that the friendship, the camaraderie, was as important in the BSI as the scholarship. And it's true. I think it's true.
I think we would all agree. You know, part of what makes this little hobby enjoyable is the people in whose company you get to attend these events.
Indeed. And we can now share our friendship much more easily when we're not actually together. We can enjoy that friendship when we're not actually together, as we're doing now.
Indeed. Well, thank you for the gift of your friendship, even though it is from thousands of miles away. We feel it strongly here. And I speak of, you know, the entire Sherlockian community as well as just Bert and I individually. It means a great deal what you do and continue to do.
I will reciprocate that. We love you guys, and we are so grateful for what you do.
Oh.
Thank you.
Well, Gene, you know, you're obviously your relationship together with Roger, you know, the two of you are one of the original Sherlockian power couples out there. we're grateful for your wonderful collaboration together. It really is a meeting of equals. And as we just mentioned to Roger, the friendship that we feel to both of you, both collectively as an audience as well as individually, we couldn't be more grateful for it.
Oh, well, thank you for that. But as Roger was saying, you know, it is the relationship with other people with a common interest that's what makes it so enjoyable. And I think there's so much tolerance as well for the eccentricities that we all have. Because, like, for example, I discovered just a couple of years ago, I'm on the autism spectrum, which a lot of people would find a little difficult to deal with. But fortunately, people tolerate me. We've got enough in common that they can sort of get past my lack of filters.
Well, now we've tumbled onto the secret ingredient responsible for your success with that group of British physicians in Philadelphia.
There you go. Well, Gene, thank you so much for the pleasure of your company for the last hour or so. And
thank you.
Sure. We wish you all the best.
Same to you guys.
Well, how delightful. My only regret is that it took so long for us to have Roger and Gene on the program.
This is something I think we've been talking about for a decade, or, you know, we've been doing this now for 11 years. Yeah. And one of our earliest observations to each other was, oh boy, you know, let's talk to, the Society of London. Let's talk to, the folks in France. And, we finally did it.
Indeed we did. You know, scheduling is a little tough, but, glad we did. Glad we did. And, you know, Rogers and Jeans is such a, in some ways a unique story. Living in Christopher Morley's house and getting engaged to a Sherlockian there. I mean, obviously that's a, one of a kind. But in another sense, their story about coming to Sherlock Holmes and finding other similar-minded people, and finding their niche, It's the story that we all have in one way or another.
Yes. Yeah. Making those kinds of connections. The lovely thing is that Roger is such a, well, Roger and Jean, I mean, they are invaluable repositories yes. of the history of major events in the Sherlockian world. And the lovely thing about this conversation was for them to have at their fingertips, even down to the names of the people who were participating and instrumental in the construction of the Festival of Britain exhibition in the early days of the society.
Yeah.
I'm just happy we captured some of this for historical reasons, not the least of which is my additional happiness at just having just so much joy in talking to them. And by the way, we will have this in the show notes, but our listeners can take a look at the Flickr gallery associated with the Sherlock Holmes Society of London and see some photographs. So you can see exactly what Roger and Jean and many others look like.
Yeah. And see the activities that they're up to. You know, we didn't spend an inordinate amount of time on it because this, after all, was an interview, about Roger and Jean, not about the SHSL. But there are so many things that the Sherlock Holmes Society of London gets up to, whether it's these major excursions to Switzerland that they do every decade or so, or their weekend outings or the cricket matches or what have you. I am a member of the society myself, albeit a corresponding member. Boy, do I wish I lived in England to be able to partake of some of these events on a regular basis.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never made it to one of the cricket matches, but there's always next year.
Sure. Well, speaking of events to attend and news in the Sherlockian world, thought it appropriate for us to kick off this slight news interruption with a mention of Wessex Press's From Gillette to Brett 5. Registration is hopping, and I believe, from what I'm told, is that it is the most subscribed From Gillette to Brett event that they've had yet. And the even better news is we will be there. We will be on the ground at the event in October in Bloomington, Indiana. And we may even pull out our recording device there. We may even try a live broadcast depending on what we can come across. We'll see, but stay tuned for that.
Yes. And if you have any interest, folks, in going to this, the original, we early on, you know, we're working on attending, and so I'm really looking forward to being there. But the first block of rooms went in a nanosecond, and the second block of rooms went in a nanosecond. And so, sadly but appropriately, Scott and I will be sharing a cardboard box at the bus station. But the advantage is it's near the Dunkin' Donuts, so we won't have any problem with breakfast coffee.
Although we may be inundated with ears in our cardboard box. So we'll have to keep a lookout for that. What else is going on in the Sherlockian world that you've heard of?
Me?
Yeah, sure.
I am so out of touch with the news flow. I've just been swamped.
Oh dear.
With work. I don't think I have a clue.
Oh dear. We are.
Oh no. Well, I've got some vague clues. There is a new book out. Conan Doyle for the Defense by the very interesting and talented Marguerite Fox, and I have a suspicion that she might actually be a future guest on a podcast somewhere. So that's a publication event I've noted.
Well, that could very well be. Who knows? We came across an article in UConn Today. That's UConn, not YUKON. That's as in the University of Connecticut, which was an interview with Pamela Bedore, an associate professor of English and writing at UConn's Avery Point campus. And she teaches a number of classes there, including popular fiction. And she's written a book called Dime Novels and the Roots of American Detective Fiction. And the interview with her, which was an audio interview, is called The Popularity of Sherlock Holmes. And I think it touches right on what we were just discussing with Roger and Gene, that, you know, we are in the midst of a golden age, and that Sherlock Holmes's popularity just continues to reach rarefied heights.
It's absolutely amazing. Amazing. I never would have predicted it, but it's very, very gratifying. And the nice part about it is it shows no signs of stopping at all.
That's right. And that's a wonderful thing. One last bit of news. This is in the realm of theater, and some folks may recognize this name. Ken Ludwig has a new play out called Baskerville, a Sherlock Holmes mystery, and it is making its way through the D.C. Philadelphia area. And I'm sure it will be available and coming to other theaters around the country before long. We of course had Ken Ludwig on as our guest once upon a time. I think it was I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere episode 73, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right.
A conversation with playwright Ken Ludwig. Look for more wonderful things coming from Ken to a theater near you.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, I had been up in New Haven when Baskerville was put on at New Haven and did an after show conversation with the audience about Sherlock Holmes, which was a lot of fun. Also, one of the things I wanted to mention, if any of our listeners have an interest in Shakespeare, you know, we tend to attract a lot of English majors, myself included, to this kind of interest and enthusiasm. Ken wrote a book a couple of years ago called How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare. And it is, if you have any interest in Shakespeare and the beauty of Shakespearean language and how you might communicate that enthusiasm to a younger generation, I've really enjoyed his book, so I would recommend that to you.
Well, that's a good call. Well, of course, we've reached that time in the program where we're going to be putting the screws to you. That's right, it's the canonical couplet, that little quiz program that you've come to love and know, or loathe and know, depending on which way you take it. We have had lots of folks participate once again when we gave the last clue. And again, this is a short couplet, and you are to identify the story that is referenced by this bit of poetry. And the last time we said, "To see a genius in his tracks arrested, just whisper Norbury, as he requested." And that, of course, refers to which adventure, Bert?
Oh, that's the Norwood Gables, I think.
The Norwood Gables. That's a new one. That is a new one. I was going for the Westchester filigree.
Oh, you know, it's really funny you should mention that. Last Sunday for lunch, I had the Westchester filigree. It was delicious.
Now, was that with or without HP sauce?
Oh, without. I don't like the HP sauce, but I always have it with the poached egg.
There you go. Well, of course, that was that was the adventure of the yellow face. The yellow face. Of course, Holmes asked Watson to whisper Norbury in his ear if he got a little too far ahead of himself in the future. Kind of a request from Sherlock Holmes to remain flat-footed on the ground. And we had a number of submissions, a number of people submitting the correct answers. So we will once again turn to the great revolving drum. Spin it around here until we arrive at the number, let's see. Oh, number 12. And that means our winner is, let me see, who's number 12 here down the list here? Paul Miller. Paul Miller, over in the UK. How appropriate, since we just interviewed two fine folks from the UK. Paul, we will be in touch with you and arrange to have something, from our archive sent your way. Well, that means that now we need to have the clue for this week's, or this episode's canonical couplet. Are we ready?
Okay. Yes.
Here we go. from this important record, it appears that Holmes was pretty good at 60 years. If you know which tale that refers to, shoot us an email at comment@iHearOfSherlock.com with canonical couplet in the subject line and give it your best shot. Good luck. Well, we've got another wonderful program lined up for you next time around in IHO's 149. Are we up to 149? Oh, my good grief. We're closing
close
in on
to a monster.
50, yeah. Is that the sesquicentennial that'll be 150? Is that how it works?
No, that's in Susquehanna. We're nowhere near there.
Well, we need to go on site for that. Our Susquehanna sesquicentennial.
Yeah, I like that. Live from Susquehanna.
I want to come live from Walla Walla, Washington. Just because I like saying Walla Walla, Washington.
Walla Walla, Washington.
One day, one day. Well, until that day arrives, I am trapped in this body and this voice, being Scott Monty.
I am very corporeally Bert Wolder.
the game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
Still working on it?
Oh, sorry, I was on mute.